Thank you for joining us today for a message from the Word of God. What follows is a recording from one of our live services at Gooch Lane Church of Christ in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you join us in person. And if you like what you hear today, you can visit us online at teachingtruth.org, where we have videos, weekly articles on biblical topics, information about our services, and more.
Good evening. Glad you're all here. You can say good evening back. Thank you. Good to hear some little interaction there. I want you to know my plan this weekend is for things not to be just informational, but inspirational and motivational, and if need be, transformational in nature also. Now, we put together some pretty detailed outlines of each of these lessons, and that's primarily so you can set the notes aside and give me eye contact, all right? I don't want to look out and have you guys reading ahead. Besides, jokes aren't funny if you read them ahead, right? So seriously, I'd really appreciate it if you could, you know, have the discipline to wait until I make reference to the notebook of handouts. In part two, I'm going to ask you to turn to page 7, and we're going to go through some practical information. Each one of these sessions, I'm going to give you some homework. I just can't help myself. I've been a college professor too long. But, you know, the transformation comes in the processing of the material, comes in the doing. Knowledge is of no benefit unless you apply it, right? Unless you put it to use. And so my desire each time is to come up with a set of things that you can take home with you and that you can talk, especially if you're married, to your spouses about, and hopefully really grow in meaningful ways in your relationship. So thank you for coming. I'm glad that you are here. Let me begin by asking you this question. Have you ever heard people of the world, and sometimes even brethren, when they talk about marriage, talk about the marriage contract? Let me see your hands. How many of you hear people talk about the marriage contract? Well, at least some of you do. I hear this all the time, and every time I hear it, it's like nails on a chalkboard. Because this idea of marriage as being a contract is actually unscriptural. We don't want to talk and think about marriage as being a contract. We want to talk about this in the way the Bible refers to marriage. Marriage is a spiritual covenant, and that is what makes all the difference. In my marriage counseling, if somebody's coming to me and they have trouble, I tell them, you're supposed to be a part of a spiritual covenant, and any marriage problem is basically a spiritual problem. So we're going to look at the spiritual aspect of this and see if we can't figure out how your marriage can be improved. And that is often overlooked and not even discussed, and that is so sad because that is the foundation of everything in marriage. So think about marriage as a covenant. And in part one, we're going to talk about marriage as a spiritual covenant and how it differs from a contract. For example, Malachi 2 and verse 14, she is my companion and the wife of thy covenant, not contract. And in Proverbs 2, 16 and 17, Solomon warns, deliver thee from the strange woman that forsaketh the friend of her youth, a reference to her husband, and forgets the covenant of her God. So the Bible talks about marriage as being a covenant. Well, what exactly is a covenant? It actually comes from a Hebrew word that is defined as following, in the sense of cutting a compact made by passing between pieces of flesh. What in the world is that? Well, there's several places where God goes through a certain ceremony with his people to indicate that they are becoming a part of a covenant relationship with him. It starts in Genesis 15, 9 and 10, and then later on in verse 17 and 18. It says, God took selected sacrifices. The context is he's getting ready to institute the Abrahamic covenant, the wonderful covenant through which the land and the nation and the seed promise will be fulfilled. Started right here, way back in Genesis 15. And he says that they took these sacrifices and divided them in the midst. And it came to pass when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, there was a smoking furnace and a burning lamp, and they passed between the pieces. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. If I understand this correctly, they take these calves and they dismember them. And then in this case, Abram, later his name's going to be changed to Abraham after this ceremony. He walks between the pieces here of this sacrifice. And they gather up the pieces and they put it on an altar. And they have a solemn prayer and a devotion before God. This covenant is based upon worshiping God and having a relationship with Him and sort of sealing this upon their hearts and designated a certain time when this covenant relationship begins and a sort of a changing of the vows. The thing to keep in mind whenever you think about a covenant, God is involved and central to the agreement. You know, our forefathers who put together the traditions for a modern wedding ceremony, they understood that marriage was a covenant. And the traditions that we get involved in when we go to a wedding, it all goes back to their realization of this. But most people, they go through a wedding and it's all become secular. All the spiritual meaning behind it has been dropped and forgotten. Now, I understand why our secular world wouldn't want to go back to its religious and spiritual roots, but I don't, for the life of me, understand why so many brethren are not taught and aware of what we're going to talk about tonight. So after we get done talking a little bit more about a covenant versus a contract, I'm going to tell you about how the marriage ceremony reflects this whole idea of a spiritual covenant that the couple is entering into. And once I figured this out, it's just, a wedding has never been the same to me. It's just opened up a whole new vista of appreciation and understanding for what we do in our modern wedding ceremonies. All right. Let's remember that when we think about covenant versus contract, the marriage covenant, of course, is a sacred one. It takes two to tango, but it takes three to get married. We learn that God joins the couple together in heaven, and what God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. The thing I like to say about this is it's a holy triune, not a human duet. And it can't just be easily severed by, you know, the parties involved. I want to move on. I've had it. You've also made promises to God. There's a triangle here that you need to keep in mind. And one of the keys to intimacy in marriage is to understand if both parties focus on God and getting closer to God, as they both get closer to God, they automatically get closer to one another. It's a holy triune. That's what we talk about. Sacred matrimony, because God is at the center of all of this. It's a picture of my youngest daughter, Allison, and her husband, Brad, who live in Temple Terrace, Florida. And this was them asking God's blessings upon their marriage covenant back in 2008 when they tied the knot together. You know, it's really sad that so many people, when they enter into a dating relationship and they start getting serious, so often they're in such a hurry to get married. And people often get married not having known each other for very long. Man, that is so risky. And I tell people in my counseling, I go, what is the hurry? You've got the rest of your life to be married. Savor being single. Enjoy it. Savor the courtship. Enjoy it. Don't rush it. And so many people, without giving adequate consideration, just sort of march down the aisle without really counting the cost and thinking through the seriousness of what they're about to enter into. Solomon had something to say about this in Proverbs 20 and verse 25. This is the NASV. It is a snare to rashly say it is holy. You're going to enter into something that is sacred. And then later, make inquiry. Kind of like, oops, I wish I hadn't done that. Too many people get married until divorce do them part. Instead of until death do them part. This is supposed to be a lifelong covenant relationship That's God's plan. And whenever that plan is violated, people get hurt. I am so sad to see all the broken homes. We've got to stop the broken homes and the broken vows and the broken hearts that are all around us. Another translation says, it is a danger to a man to say without thought, it is holy, and after taking his vows, to be questioning if it is necessary to keep them. Yes, it is necessary to keep them because you made them before God. It's not just like a business contract. You know, Brent and I might go into business, and then I may say, you know, you're too good at business. I can't handle this. I just can't compete. So we're going to just drop this. And he can go, okay, you know, whatever you want. I mean, we can do that in a human contract, but not in a spiritual contract where God joins you together in heaven. And the first thing we need to do is really teach people how serious this is and make sure they count the cost before they enter into this kind of commitment. The Message paraphrase says this: an impulsive vow is a trap, and later you'll wish you could get out of it. And that is absolutely so. And so we need to understand how important a covenant relationship is. You know, I had to just laugh at Britney Spears. In 2004, she had a New Year's fling. She decided on a whim to marry her childhood friend, Jason Alexander. And 55 hours later, that marriage was annulled. So they just kind of, on a fluke, said, yeah, let's get married. And they legally got married. So we're supposed to marry until death do us part. And this particular one lasted 55 hours. I mean, that just makes a mockery of marriage. Kim Kardashian, in 2011, they got married on TV. It was a multi-million dollar extravaganza. It was Kim and an NBA star, Chris Humphries. And they were all saying they were going to, you know, get married for life and had all these meaningful vows. They got divorced on Halloween. So they lasted 72 days. And it took 18 months to finish the divorce proceedings and dividing up all the assets. I think maybe they should have thought that one through a little bit more before, you know, announcing to the world this multi-million dollar wedding extravaganza that didn't last long at all. It's just really, really sad when you think about those things. If you have an understanding of what a real covenant is all about, you achieve the unity or the oneness that God desires for marriage. I just love this piece of prose that shows God's plan. Listen carefully. This is entitled Unity. Man satisfies the woman satisfies the man. God blesses the union. Man plants the seed. Woman bears the child. God gives the spirit. Man sets the discipline standards. Woman sets the love standards. God balances discipline with love. Man is the breadwinner. Woman is the bread warmer. Isn't that neat? And God is the bread provider. Man is woman's hero. Woman is man's cheerleader. God is the coach. Man leads as the woman's head. The woman follows as the man's body. God makes them become one flesh. And man presents a picture of Christ. The woman presents a picture of the church. And God makes them joint heirs. I mean, that is clearly something that has God's divine, omniscient stamp upon it. And it is something we ought to view with great appreciation and even reverence. Let's talk about the specific differences between a three-way divine covenant and a two-way human contract that I alluded to earlier. God's design is that the marriage be based upon trust, like our relationship with Him must be based upon trust, while a human contract, by definition, is based upon distrust. I mean, you're mostly familiar, I'm sure, with real estate contracts and how you put some earnest money up when you make an offer. And the idea is that though that's supposed to be a good faith offer, If they put down just a little, it's an indication that they're not very serious, because if you walk away from the contract, you forfeit your earnest money. But you're not obligated otherwise. Most of contract law is based upon people trying to limit their liabilities. And they are arm's length transactions that you engage in with somebody that you don't know well, typically, and therefore someone that you don't really trust. And so you have your lawyer look at everything before you sign it, and you want to make sure that it's notarized and everything is done legally, because you want to protect yourself from this person over on the other side of this arm's length transaction. Marriage shouldn't be an arm's length transaction. Marriage ought to be personal and meaningful, and over time you've developed faith in each other and you trust one another. Over and over again in our culture, prenuptial agreements, are so common. And there may be some cases when you get married, maybe older in life, where there may be some, you know, place for a prenup. But the sad thing is, so many people are entering the prenup because basically they don't trust each other. And they're afraid that later on this person might bail on them and then, you know, cause them all kind of loss financially and kind of take them to the cleaners. So to protect yourself, you have this prenup. I can't imagine going down the aisle marrying someone, and right before you went down the aisle to, you know, pledge yourself to this other person, you met with your attorneys and you've had this prenup agreement, just in case. No, marriage, it's like you're both jumping in feet first, and you trust one another, and it is an act of faith. So many people have all these contingency plans. One of the most bizarre things that I've heard of was in 2004, there was a prenup agreement signed between Catherine Zeta-Jones and Michael Douglas, big Hollywood wedding. And they actually signed in the prenup that if Michael Douglas was unfaithful to Catherine Zeta-Jones, that was okay, but it would cost him $5 million. Yeah, I know you're probably going to cheat on me, but just in case you do, I want it up front that it's going to cost you $5 million. Do you imagine entering into a love relationship and get married to somebody and you have that kind of negotiation? Unbelievable. No wonder the divorce rate is so high and so many marriages fail. You know, so many people go out there and they take people for better or for worse, but not for long. That doesn't make any sense. So our relationship with God has to be based upon trust. And I tell couples that if you don't trust this person and you're afraid, you're filled with some fear about what they might do to you later if this, quote, doesn't work out, don't marry them. Please do not marry someone that you think might be untrustworthy. God's covenant with us is based upon trust, and a marriage covenant, if it's what it should be, has to be based upon trust. And by the way, that takes time. That's why you shouldn't rush into this. A three-way covenant is based upon unlimited responsibility. Think about God when he made the Abrahamic promise. It's going to take him 2,000 years to fulfill the three elements of that promise. And the people, Abraham's descendants, for most of that time are going to forget about the Abrahamic promise and the covenant and decide they want to live pagan lives like the nations round about them and completely just forget God's plan for them and for Abraham's descendants. And he's going to work with them for 2,000 years. And he's going to have to take them into captivity, and he's going to have to be long-suffering, he's going to have to send them all these prophets. He never gave up on them and eventually brought forth the Messiah. Praise God. But how God had to work through and keeping his word, even though the other side was so uncooperative, is just a perfect example of this unlimited responsibility that we're supposed to have when we enter into marriage as well. And that is indicated by, like, the traditional vows, where you take somebody for better, for worse, for richer, or poor, or for sickness and in health. In other words, I don't know what the future holds, but we're going to be loyal to each other. That's the nature of unlimited responsibility. Two-way covenant, of course, as we mentioned, is limiting one's liability and really not taking this whole thing very seriously. One of the things that's disturbed me over the years is going to weddings and hearing the vows watered down. Sometimes they're secular and God is hardly mentioned, and yet this whole relationship, the core of it is supposed to be spiritual. And I went to a wedding of one of my wife's relatives one time. And they said in this wedding ceremony that we will stay together as long as we make each other laugh. And I'm sitting there in the audience on the pew thinking, you're committing to stay to one another until the jokes get stale? Are you kidding me? What kind of a vow is that? And then other times I've heard people say, well, we will stay together and vow to be together as long as we are sharing our love with each other. And usually what they're talking about there is sort of a romanticized kind of, you know, sensibility about love. And if anybody has been alive for very long, you know that romantic love especially kind of has an ebb and flow to it. I mean, some days you're sick, you have the flu. You're not going to be real amorous on days like that. I mean, there are just things that happen in life, and it's not all rainbows and unicorns, right? But here they are at the altar saying, only as long as we can share love will we stay together. It sounds good, but it's really weak. And the one that has become really common and popular is that we will stay together as long as we meet each other's needs. Now, again, on the surface, that doesn't sound so bad, but when you stop and think about it, what that really is a cost-benefit analysis, just like you would do in a contract. And, you know, I'm going to get so much out of this, and I expect you to give me certain things and vice versa. And if I ever feel like that you're not pulling your end of the bargain and that I'm not getting out of this what I think I deserve and what I need, then I'm out of here and I'm going to find somebody else that's going to give me more than what you're giving me now. You know what that is? That's selfishness. The modern American marriage is a contract based upon selfishness. And you get married because you think you're going to get a good payoff. And if the person ever is in a car accident or things change and they can't give you what you thought you were going to get from them, then they say up front that I'm going to bail on you and bail on this relationship. And they have the gall to basically tell the world that's what this relationship is all about. No wonder the average American marriage only lasts 8 years. That is so sad. Love American style is a terrible failure because it's a contractual relationship, not a spiritual covenant. True godly marriage is based upon agape love. It's supposed to be a love relationship, not a selfish relationship. The idea of agape love is that you're willing to sacrifice for the other person, the object of your love. Jesus loved us, and so he sacrificed for us. So real marriage is based upon selflessness toward the other party instead of selfishness, which is what you have today in most very surface secular kind of ceremonies. And as I alluded to earlier, a three-way divine covenant is to be lifelong until death do you part. And it's not to be broken. And if it is broken and one party commits adultery, The only reason why the thing is broken is because sin occurred. God is not glorified. It's never a positive experience. It's so sad how many people enter into a marriage saying, well, if it doesn't work out, we can always get a divorce. God forbid that that would be any child of God's attitude toward marriage. A human contract can be voided by mutual consent, not a contract between God and the two parties. We're really serious about pleasing God and ultimately getting to heaven. All right. A contract says, I take thee for me. A covenant says, I give myself to thee. A contract says, you would better do it, because that's what we agreed to. Do this or else. A covenant says, how may I serve you? It's completely voluntary. A contract says, what do I get out of this? Covenant says, what can I give? A contract says, I'll meet you halfway. It's a 50-50 kind of a thing. Covenant says, I'm going to give you 100% and more if I can, because I'm not keeping tabs on who's giving the other more attention or doing more. I just want to make sure I'm doing my part because I love you. Contract says I have to, because I'm stuck, because I have this contract. Covenant says I want to. You can't have real love with any kind of coercion involved. Main difference between a covenant and a contract. Now, let's go back to what I mentioned earlier, and then we'll be done with part one. And that is, if you ever noticed that when you walk into like a church building and you're going to attend a wedding, there's ushers there, and the first question they ask is, whose side are you on? Isn't that interesting? Whose side are you on? And of course, if you're with the bride and her family, you sit on one side, and if you're with the groom and his family, you sit on the other. But there's always a center aisle. Why is the bride always want to come down a center aisle? Why is that so important? Because it's a picture of the covenant offering. And you come down here to the preacher who's going to lead you in prayer. This is the place where God is, where God joins you together in heaven. And the people that you invite to your wedding are your family members and your dearest friends, and many times people travel long distances to come. These are really important people in your life. They're the living sacrifices that the bride walks down through as they come down to the altar, where they are joined together by God himself in a very solemn ceremony where vows are exchanged. This goes back to Genesis 15, folks. The whole wedding is set up as a picture of these covenant living sacrifices. Amazed how many people don't even know that's what's supposed to be going on. And why is there often a white runner that they sometimes bring down? Again, the idea is sort of like when Moses approached God in the burning bush, he said, take off your shoes for you're on holy ground. The white runner is supposed to indicate the sacredness of what's about to happen and the purity of the holy ground, where the preacher and the bride and the groom are together getting ready to enter into a three-pronged sacred ceremony. Typically, when I do a wedding, there's a little side door over here or something, and at the appropriate moment after the parents and the grandparents have been set, then the preacher and the best man and the groom come out first. And then you wait for, here comes the bride. And then the mother of the bride usually motions, okay, it's time. She stands up, and then everybody gives honor to the bride as she walks down the aisle. But why is it that the groom enters and comes out first and waits for his bride? because he is the covenant initiator and he has the greater responsibility. And hopefully he proposed to her and not the reverse. Because the essence of romance is pursuit. And the man is the one that pursues in a loving and sincere way the heart of his bride. What other symbolism do we have? The father walks the bride down the aisle, right? Well, what is that supposed to mean? Well, a couple of things. First, according to Deuteronomy 22, the father's responsibility is to keep his daughter pure and protect her from others. And so this is his role. His daughter is one that he is supposed to protect and provide for and to lead. And the reason you ask the father's permission for his daughter's hand in marriage is because he is voluntarily trusting this man in her life, this groom, to take over those responsibilities. You know, when my two daughters got married, it was a day of mixed emotions. I mean, they married wonderful Christian young men. We were thrilled that they were entering into such a wonderful relationship. But I remember, you know, the tear coming down my cheek is Amy and Jonathan, my oldest daughter, drove off, you know, to their honeymoon suite because she wasn't daddy's little girl anymore. I'm no longer the head of her home. Her husband is her head. She's no longer in submission to me as her father. She's in submission to her husband. And so it's his job. You know, the man, after being asked who gives this woman away in marriage, typically says, her mother and I do. And then he takes the hand of the groom and puts it in the hand of his daughter. And then the ceremony begins. It's his way of passing on the authority and passing on the blessing. And she wears a white dress because hopefully she's maintained her moral purity. And it's not just a fashion statement. And it is a wonderful gift that is given. And so he gives his undefiled and pure daughter to this man. And it's a rite of passage. And I have to tell you that though I felt sort of sad about giving up the role as the primary leader, kind of pilot and protector of my daughter, I was kind of glad to say, okay, you pay the bills. You're now also the provider. My daughters are finally off the payroll. See, there's some good that comes from this rite of passage, right? Though it's kind of emotional. It's the transfer of the authority over to the groom who now is going to pilot and provide and protect the father's daughter. One of my favorite parts of a wedding ceremony is when we introduce the couple. You know, I remember in our wedding, it was, we're now, for the first time ever, pleased to introduce to you Mr. and Mrs. Carlton Brent Hunter. Yes, Brent's my middle name. And everybody cheers, you know, and you seal it with a kiss, and you know, you walk down the aisle. It's just a great moment. You change the name. Why? It's a covenant that's been instituted, just like right after the covenant was instituted, Abram, that meant exalted father, becomes exalted father of many nations, Abraham. And Sarai, who means princess, becomes the exalted princess of many nations. The covenant is so significant that when you get done, you actually take on a new name. The marriage is so important that the woman takes on the name of the husband. There's a changing of names that occurs. And you know, it's also a spiritual nature. In our spiritual covenant, what happens after you come up out of the watery grave of baptism? Now you're called a Christian. And that's the most sacred, beautiful name you could ever imagine taking on. And hopefully you will be faithful unto death to your Lord Jesus. And you now wear his name. What you do in covenants. What is the significance of the signing of the guest book? You know, this has sort of been lost. You know, unfortunately, most of the time, people sign the guest book as you walk in to make sure you don't miss anybody. It didn't used to be done that way. It's fairly recent kind of a phenomenon of convenience. Now, what it used to be that people would sign the book in the reception area as an indication that they were witnesses of the vows. That's the original idea behind the guest book. It's not just to keep all the records together so you can send thank you notes for all the gifts. I mean, that may be good etiquette, but don't forget that when you go to a wedding, you're a witness. They start off, this man and woman are together before God and many what? Witnesses. And why is that so important? Because those witnesses heard the vows. And they're expected to help the couple to keep those vows and to support the marriage and the family. When I get done with a wedding, I tell people that your signature is one of a witness. And after the couple has exchanged vows with each other, I say, now I'm going to ask the audience to make a vow to the couple because they need your support. And then I ask them, will you pledge to support this couple? And if you ever hear them violating these vows in any way, to care enough to call it to their attention and to help them because they need your support. And then I ask everyone to affirm by saying, I agree. And there's a vow exchange between the audience, the witnesses, and the couple. It's just such a shame that most of the time we don't hear about a marriage that's falling apart and a divorce that's coming until it's already been decided and it's too late. Where's the communication? Where's the background and the support? You know, in Armenia, the divorce rate is like 0.4%. It's almost unheard of. And what they do, because it's primarily a Catholic country, is they, at the ceremony, they have what they call godparents appointed to, in a special way, help support this couple if they're ever in trouble. And they're supposed to be an exemplary couple, and they can go to them for advice and whatever. And if anybody in the village ever hears that they're having trouble or, you know, they hear they're fighting and all this kind of stuff, then what happens is the people in the village who knows this young couple will contact the godparents, and they immediately stop what they're doing, show up with their bags, and say, we hear you guys are having trouble. That happens. We're here to help you to get through the trouble. Here are our bags. We're going to stay for a while. And we're not leaving until we're convinced you're okay. And if for no other reason to get their privacy back, they take very seriously the counsel and the help of their godparents. Now, I'm not suggesting we do that, but I am suggesting that we have avenues of communication and sharing where we help people through difficulties instead of people waiting until it's too late to get help, which is this sad thing that I find. Most of the time, couples come to me for counseling. They should have been here 2 years ago when the troubles first started. They wait till they're already talking about divorce, and a lot of times the damage is already done. But that's what the idea of those witnesses are. It's your support system. And what's the purpose of the receiving line? I used to think it was so I would get a chance to kiss the bride on the cheek. No, that's not the reason. The purpose of the receiving line is so you can get a blessing, maybe some wisdom, from the people that came to this wedding that can help aid you in your relationship. And that's exactly what we find happening in Ruth chapter 4, where they're given a blessing by all these people in attendance. One of the things that's very common now in weddings, last couple of weddings I've been to, they actually have a little book outside, and the married people can leave words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom for the young couple. That's really getting back to the way the original weddings were when things were much more successful and divorce was really rare. And why is there food at the reception? Why is there always some sort of marital banquet that follows this exchanging of the vows and the blending of the two families together and the taking on of a new name. It's a celebration. This is a great event. And so you celebrate it with food. It's the covenant celebration. That's what the reception is. Kind of reminds me of Christians, the first thing they do after they take on the name of Christ and they're baptized into Christ for the remission of their sins, they now can partake of the Lord's Supper. And they're one in the bread and one in the body. And the Lord's Supper is supposed to be a celebratory meal of what Christ and his blood has done for all of us. And what it means for our future, because we're a part of a covenant. Our secular culture has just kind of left all this out. And what a shame, because this is really meaningful. And why do they share the food back and forth? Usually it's a funny picture and you're kind of getting cake on each other's face and everybody's laughing. But the idea is, what's mine is yours and yours is mine and vice versa. We're one flesh, we're sharing. Just like we're one in the bread and one in the body. All this has to do with being in covenant relationship. When I was a young preacher, I used to talk about the rings. Rings are really important of engagement, and are there rings and the exchanging of the rings. And I used to talk about how they're round, symbolizing, it's never-ending nature. So should be the nature of your love. And they're gold and maybe diamonds, which, symbolize love's preciousness. And wear this always as a public profession of your love for one another. It's all well and good. But it should be secondary to the fact that the rings are supposed to be a token of the covenant. Your marriage covenant with God, it's to be there until death do you part. God puts a rainbow in the sky after most every rain as a reminder of the covenant that he made with us, that he would never again destroy the earth with water. It's a token of that precious covenant and promise, and it never gets out of date. And there's no statute of limitations on it. The rainbow is a token of the covenant, and this ring is a token of the marriage covenant that I have with my wonderful wife, Gail. And I'm forever thankful for it and the covenant that it represents. Okay, that's the end of part one. Let's take about 7 minutes, go to the bathroom, do whatever you need to do, and then we'll come back and we're going to talk about refreshing and reinstilling marital commitment. Thank you so much for being here. And please, come back. Part two is important.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have questions about anything you heard today or anything Bible-related, you can use the contact form on our website at teachingtruth.org to submit a question and someone will be in touch. There's also lots of other great Bible content on our site as well. The web address again is teachingtruth.org. Once again, thanks for listening, and we hope to see you in person soon.